few comments about the state of the priesthood, that the approach that this text takes to the state of the priesthood. And I wanted to make that a little clearer this morning and say that it's not necessarily my opinion of the priesthood, although some I've run into priests and pastors who don't seem to know which end is up. But it's actually the position that this text, this biblical text, takes on the state of the priesthood at the time of Samuel's birth and call, to set us up for the unique ministry that Samuel will have. It's a narrative technique to let us know how important and how distinct Samuel is from anybody that we've seen for a long time in the text, or anyone that we will see for quite some time. And to point up some of that, let's go back to 1 Samuel 2. We'll pick up in verse 11, and at the end of the hour, we'll come back to this wonderful song in 1 through 10. 11 starts up after Samuel has been dedicated to his poem, his song of Hannah. Then Elkanah went home to Ramah, while the boy remained to minister to the Lord in the presence of the priest Eli. And that word there, minister, is what many of us pastors need to be reminded of from time to time, that it's actually a word of service. And in this case, I believe that Samuel was actually a young boy who was basically the gopher for the priest. He was schlepping things around. That's not to suggest that that's what I think a pastor should be doing these days, schlepping things around for the congregation. But that we need to be reminded that this is the word, one of the words in the Hebrew, a vocabulary for a servant. Now the description of the priesthood. It's been hinted at earlier that, as I mentioned, Eli didn't recognize sincere, fervent prayer, thought that Hannah was drunk. And the next chapter, when we get there, chapter 3, when we get there, we'll see that they actually tell us that he's blind, or virtually blind. But they really lay it out here when they're talking about his sons. Now the sons of Eli were scoundrels, and they had no regard for the Lord or for the duties of the priest to the people. When anyone offered sacrifice, the priest's servant would come while the meat was boiling with a three-pronged fork in his hand, and he would thrust it into the pan, or a kettle, or cauldron, or pot. All that the fork brought up, the priest would take for himself. This is what they did at Shiloh, to all the Israelites who came there. Moreover, before the fat was burned, the priest would come and say to the one who was sacrificing, "Give meat for the priest to roast, for he will not accept boiled meat from you, but only raw." And if that man said to him, let them burn the fat first, then take whatever you wish," he would say, "No, you must give it now. If not, I will take it by force." Thus, the sin of the young man was very great in the sight of the Lord, for they mistreated the offerings of the Lord. For they treated the offerings of the Lord with contempt. So this is a picture of the sons of Eli. And what's going on in this central sanctuary in Shiloh. And to make it clear to us that we're in real need of a change. Is it Time magazine I saw in the airport had a big thing about religion and society this past week and how much trouble we're in? Newsweek. I can't tell the difference. Sounds like, at least in some popular ways, things never change.
Peter?
Yes?
Were there rules about burning off the fat and when they boiled or when they roasted?
Yeah, if you're brave enough to read Leviticus, you'll see all these rules are laid out as to how things are supposed to be done, when the priests get their portion, and basically what they're doing here is they're taking their best shot at getting the best cut of meat in the best condition for flavor and so on, rather than letting Yahweh, God, get the best portion, which is what a sacrifice is all about. Put the best things forward for God, and then if there's something left over from the priest, that's when they get to eat. And they reversed it here. If you skip over to verse 22. Verse 21 is a little piece that we touched on. I guess I touched on with somebody in passing yesterday as to whether or not Hannah had other children. I'm just wondering about, someone was wondering about the woman who was so fervent to have a child, and as soon as she had one, gave it up. Well, here in verse 21, we see, and the Lord took note of Hannah. She conceived and bore three sons and two daughters, and the boy Samuel grew in the presence of the Lord. So what the story was about as far as Hannah was concerned is the ability to bear. And here it's excuse the pun, borne out that she in fact continued to be reproductive, so to speak. But would someone pick up with 22 through 25 for me?
Now Eli was very old. He heard all that his sons were doing to all Israel, and how they lay with the women who served at the entrance to the tent of meeting. And he said to them, "Why do you do such things? For I hear of your evil doings from all these people. No, my sons, it is not a good report that I hear, the people of the Lord spreading abroad. If one person sins against another, someone can intercede for the sinner with the Lord. But if someone sins against the Lord, who can make intercession? They would not listen to the voice of their father, for it was the will of the Lord to kill them."
Ouch. We're going to skip 26. If someone would pick up with 27 through 36.
One day a man of God came to Eli and said to him, "This is Yahweh's word. I revealed myself to your ancestors when they were Pharaoh's slaves in Egypt. I chose them out of all the tribes of Israel to be my priests and to go up to my altar to burn incense and wear a priest's robe in my presence. And I gave them all the burnt offerings of Israel. Why do you now look with greed on my sacrifice and the offerings that I myself ordered? Why do you listen to your sons more than to me and fatten yourselves on the choicest parts of every offering made by my people Israel? Therefore Yahweh, the God of Israel, declares, I promised that your family and that of your father should go on ministering before me forever. But now I shall no longer honor my word. Those who honor me, I shall honor. Those who despise me will be despised. The days are coming. I will break your strength and the strength of all your relatives. No one will live to a ripe old age. Then in distress you will be filled with envy, seeing how Israel prospers. Those of your household that I do not reject from my service will be spared, only to weep bitterly and live in grief. But the rest shall die by the sword. What will happen to your sons, Hophni and Phinehas, shall be assigned to you. Both of them shall die on the same day. I will raise up for myself a faithful priest who shall be just. The one I love in heart and mind, I will give him a lasting succession that will serve me and my anointed one forever. And everyone that is left of your family shall ask a priest humbly for some money or a loaf of bread, saying, appoint me, I beg you, for a priestly function so that I may have something to eat."
This is part of the story that explains why when you get to the reign of David, you have two priests to deal with. Another man's escaped me, but this, and in the book of Jeremiah, there's one reference other than this story to Shiloh in the Hebrew Bible, and that's in the book of Jeremiah. It refers to the fact that Jeremiah seems to come from the expelled priestly line that come from Everything's jumping out of my head as I get ready to say it. This little town outside of Jerusalem, where the priest of Shiloh, after they'd been pretty much decimated, moved. So we have a priestly line that's only partially functioning, and apparently at the whim of a stronger priestly line in the book of Jeremiah and in the book of Chronicles, and that's because...
Anathoth,
thank you, yes. Because the priest of Shiloh had been removed from their responsibilities. But for the purposes of this story, what we have set up here is the fact that Eli's time has come to an end. Eli's preeminence has come to an end, and we're being set up for Samuel to be most of what's described here at the end of chapter 2. One who is beloved by God, one who is faithful to God, and one who determines who will serve. And that if there is a major function for the broad picture of Israel, a major function that Samuel plays for the broad picture of Israel, it is determining who will serve the Lord. He anoints Saul, and later he anoints David. Samuel is often talked about as the kingmaker, and some think that it has to do with this prediction here that the one who will come after and the priestly slash prophetic function will determine who can serve the Lord. A couple of interesting things. In Tom's translation, it said, "Why do you listen to your, heed your sons more than me?" The Hebrew says, "Why do you respect your sons more than me?" And where it says, "I will break your strength and the strength of your," how did it translate it?
About 31. I will cut off your strength and the strength of your father's house.
Strength of your father. Oh. It's a play on words. The word zeroah, which is arm, which is a metaphor for strength, also sounds like the word zera, the word for seed, for offspring. So there's this thing. Not quite a threat, but implied threat of the loss of the entire line, as we see later, that the entire line is not lost, but practically the line is cut off because they are no longer the primary priest of Israel.
One other little thing, and this is just noting that the person who comes and delivers this message is not one of the priests at Shiloh. He's a man of God.
Yeah. And
there's another religious group running around that has some authority in all of this.
Yeah. I don't know if you all heard that, this is not one of the priests of Shiloh, but a man of God. And several times, especially in the early, in the pre-Jerusalem period, and somewhat, and a few times afterwards, there's people just show up, usually not named, and he is usually called simply a man of God. And Ish Elohim, usually, sometimes in Ish El, just a man, and then others. One of the two words for God, one of the many words for God. But, they show up, they deliver their word, and then they're gone. We don't see them again. And this is...
Are they kind of credentialed after the fact?
Well, it seems to be. And that's one of the ways we talk about verifying prophecy, is whether or not it comes to pass.
Who was that masked man?
Who was that masked prophet?
Could it have to have been necessarily could it have been an angel?
Usually they are distinguished by the use of another term. Mm-hmm. That's a good question that I don't feel like I can answer adequately because I haven't thought about it. But in some parts of the text, it's very clear that only Malach, another term, is used for angels, for messenger. Sometimes it's like in Genesis 18, you're not clear if you're talking to God or to angels. It seems to go back and forth. At one moment, it seems that God is there. Another moment, it seems that there are angels there. It could be interpreted that way, but I'm not sure how the Deuteronomistic history uses the term. Mm-hmm. So I hadn't thought about the question, so I can't give you a really good answer.
It's also possible that it's a literary device, that in Hebrew narrative, you don't have big blocks of the narrator speaking about what's going on. It's always communicated through conversation and by statements. And so this may well be the editor's comment on what he understood God to be about to do in this situation, but rather than simply putting it down as we would now, he puts it into the mouth of a mysterious character who appears to deliver what is true, but may not actually have been spoken in this form.
Many people believe that these types of literary conventions or narrative conventions occur in the Hebrew text or in all sorts of texts. I'm trying to think of can you think of a modern analogy to that? Andy, what's your last name?
Killy.
Andy is a PhD candidate at GTU in biblical studies. So, he'll be adding things that I forget from time to time. can you think of a modern analogy to any writers who use that sort of convention?
I really don't know of any because our conventions are so different.
Well, if one pops into mind, I'll come back to it. Let's go back to verse 26 for just a minute. Today is sort of a Luke day. Verse 26, the one we skipped over.
And the boy Samuel continued to grow both in stature and in favor with the Lord and with men.
Sound familiar?
Yes.
Pardon?
This came before.
I would think so. I always tease my classes to that Jesus was nothing but a plagiarizer, just to see if they're awake and getting awake enough to get mad at me. There are two points here, and the other one we'll pick up at the end of the hour with the Song of Hannah and the Magnificat, where Luke seems to be particularly keyed into Samuel as a model. For Jesus, and this is one that if you read Luke 1, 50, verse 52. 252. 252. No. Okay, yeah. 252. The Magnificat is in 1. You'll see virtually the same thing. Have you got it right there? Someone got it right there?
Luke?
Yeah. It's almost... at least in translation, I'm almost debating.
And Jesus increased in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and men.
So, fine tradition in which he stands. So this is the young man whom the narrative is telling us is preparing to step into leadership in the center of the nation of Israel. This passage tells us that he's growing in wisdom and in stature. People are beginning to know who he is, that his word is being respected. Throughout the land, we'll see that very clearly in chapter 3 when he's actually called. But also the fact that the priesthood is in such disrepair and held in such low esteem. Everybody knows. Like in some areas of Chicago, you start to talk about the priests and then talk about all the young boys and all the young girls and so on, which of course is not representative of the whole priesthood in the Roman Catholic Church. But it's out there, that kind of feeling is out there of can we trust the church anymore to tell us the truth? And so we need someone of Samuel's character. If anything is about to happen, and something is about to happen. Chapter 3 begins very similarly to the narrative part of chapter 2. We read in 2:11, Elkanah went home to Ramah, while the boy remained to minister to the Lord. And in chapter 3, now the boy Samuel was ministering to the Lord under Eli. We're reminded that at this point, Samuel's pretty much a schlepper, a gopher for the priest. This is a servant term. And the next line is very interesting to me. The word of the Lord was rare in those days. So we're at the priest's house. And the next sentence says, the word of the Lord was, the next phrase is, the word of the Lord was rare in those days. Visions were not widespread. Basically, they didn't have a clue and couldn't buy one. And that's immediately followed, this comment about vision is immediately followed by the statement about the priest's own literal visual acuity, which is often, this statement is often a metaphor for someone just basically being way up in years and in poor physical mental condition.
Was Eli's wife living?
I don't think she's mentioned at all throughout this text. Mm-hmm. And none of them, there are no women mentioned except Samuel. For a daughter-in-law.
Samuel was raised with Eli's evil sons then, by Eli.
Oh, there are probably other servants. Probably other servants, but Eli is supposed to be and we'll see in the story as the main person that Samuel is in touch with. Mm. In Exodus, Deuteronomy, just before Moses dies, we're told that he is so and so many years old and his vision has not dimmed, which is a comment about his virility, his general stature, and some people think specifically about his male virility, that it's that the vision is often connected with one's full health. But I think it's especially interesting the way it's laid out here. The word of the Lord was rare, visions were not widespread, the chief priest Eli, can't see past the end of his nose. Would someone pick up with 2 through 9?
One night, Eli, whose eyes were becoming so weak.
And this is a funny story, so you have to read it funny.
All right. One night, Eli, whose eyes were becoming so weak that he could barely see, was lying down in his usual place. The lamp of God had not yet gone out, and Samuel was lying down in the temple of the Lord, where the ark of God was. Then the Lord called Samuel. Samuel answered, "Here I am." And he ran to Eli and said, "Here I am, you called me." But Eli said, "I did not call. Go back and lie down." So he went and lay down. And again the Lord called, "Samuel." And Samuel got up and went to Eli and said, "Here I am, you called me." "My son," Eli said, "I did not call. Go back and lie down." Now Samuel did not yet know the Lord. The word of the Lord had not yet been revealed to him. The Lord called Samuel a third time, and Samuel got up and went to Eli and said, "Here I am, you called me." Then Eli realized that the Lord was calling the boy. So Eli told Samuel, "Go and lie down, and if he calls you, say, 'Speak, Lord, for your servant is listening.'" So Samuel went and lay down in his place.
Okay. That is a funny story, isn't it? Anybody who has children, or has lived with children, slept in the same house with children, this is a great story. I mean, God is calling. Or someone is calling, and those come under the bed, or the monster, and the kid keeps running in, and they say, "No, go back and lie down." And they just keep coming back because they have a certainty. Now, think about what's going on here in the story of all the reasons not to believe Samuel. First of all, he's a child. Second, the visions are rare in this time, so the idea of a vision or a dream coming to someone who's going to be discounted. Gosh, it's the middle of the night and I'm tired. Come back. So three times it takes before the chief priest realizes that maybe something extraordinary is going on here. Not much different from today, I might add. We don't listen to children very much. We don't listen to dreams or occurrences in the middle of the night very much, although that's changing somewhat these days. sometimes too much for my comfort. And we don't have a religious view of the world. Yes?
The comment that Samuel did not know yet know the Lord, and the word of the Lord had not been revealed to him, is that a further comment on, you know, if that had been the case, then perhaps Eli would have listened to Samuel. But that was not the case. And so therefore, it just adds to the story that there was no reason to believe Samuel, because the word had not yet come to him.
Right. And both sides have said that the word had already come, the word had already been revealed to him, and he knew that, then he wouldn't have run to Eli. He would have recognized the voice, I think. And if Eli had known him to be someone unique, then he would have recognized that something was going on, at least by maybe the second time. But there's no expectation of this in the temple, is, I think, the problem, or in the sanctuary. There's no expectation that God is going to speak in a unique way in this temple. I think that's part of the problem.
You're like saying, go back to bed. So, you know, you're imagining things.
There are no ghosts. I've said it myself in the last 2 weeks. What did you say?
Same thing.
There are no ghosts, there are no monsters. Go back to bed, I'm tired. So the sense of expectation is not here in the sanctuary itself.
Does this mean then that Levi really hadn't been giving the word to the people? Or was that a part of yours?
It's interesting that the primary function of the priest is to stand for the people in the presence of God, to receive the sacrifice and direct it toward God. And someone asked yesterday about receiving the prayers and directing them toward God. That's the primary stance of the priest. And the prophet's job then is to bring the word from God to the people. Although those are later distinctions. They're all, especially in the early stages, but even in the high monarchical period, pretty well fused together, that the priest and the prophet and the king, the king is always a priest. He's a military leader, and he always makes sacrifices and always seeks omens before he goes to war, before he builds a temple. So that it's not as clear cut as we'd like. You know, we have our three branches of government. They didn't quite have that then. Basically one branch of government. The joke at the University of Chicago and the Department of European Languages is that if you wanted to graduate in history, you had to know this. Two things from the history professor: religion was state business, and trade was a royal monopoly. If you knew those two things, you probably would get through at least the history classes somewhere near graduation. Let's take a couple minutes, 3 to 5 minutes, just. Turn to someone you're comfortable with, even if that just means yourself. And sometimes you might have to look to someone else. To talk about times when calls have come to into your life and you couldn't recognize them. And you had to hear them two or three or four times before you realized that this is a direction that you could reasonably go and perform some service and fulfill yourself as well.
How were you called into the ministry?
Well, you know, I don't want to. I'd be the last person to tell someone not to go into ministry. I'd also, at this point in my life, be the last person to tell someone to go into ministry. Especially for the purposes of this study, I'd like us to talk about opportunities for service rather than ministry as we usually define it as ordination. And so my story is very simple. My pastor told me, oh, you'd be good at this. And I said, who, me? And the war was on when I was in college. It's a little more complicated than that. A better story for me out of my life is summer after my sophomore year in college, I think. I went to work at Spartan Foods in Grand Rapids, Michigan, loading pallets and making, wow, more money than I'd ever seen before in my life. And I was terrible at it. Mm-hmm. And they fired me. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, like the worst 45 minutes of my life. being fired from this job, the next week I went to work at a camp in Upper Michigan and had a great time, and you know, did the kind of things that I actually really am good at, teaching, nurturing. I could have, you know, if I continued to load pallets badly, your food would have been crushed, and probably my back would have gone out 10 years earlier than it did. So I kept going to work every morning to make that money, but if, you know, I'm obviously not intended to make a lot of money in my life. You had a question or a story?
Oh, I just was remembering a piece of ancient history of my own life, but I was a campus pastor, and there were students who were going down for voter registration projects, and somewhat reluctantly, a couple of us chaplains decided, well, if the students were going, we probably ought to go along with them.
It's kind of embarrassing.
And, right? And, you know, when I think back on spring vacations, you know, very few of them can actually sort out and remember, but that's one, of course, yeah, that I do.
Yes?
I had an experience some years ago where I had this string of coincidences that involved opening newspapers and magazines and suddenly seeing articles about an organization, Amnesty International, that I had sort of been thinking about, but I kept seeing things, people kept saying things to me. I'd hear, suddenly turn on the radio, and the first thing I heard was a report on the work that this organization was doing, and I finally, after about four or five of these, concluded that maybe that God was saying I ought to get involved in this, and I did, and it turned out to be a fruitful experience for me.
And Andy would tell you that if they wrote you up, it would be the word of the Lord came to you. And maybe like the Gideon story, again and again. Pam?
I couldn't think of an example until just now, and one of the things I can think of times when I've heard a call, clearly I didn't need to be told three times, but when you were sharing, I remembered that I have often chuckled and said to other people that if you hear something three times, you better take it very seriously, because that's probably God talking to you. And I never made a connection with Samuel until just now. But that frequently, several times in my life, from different sources, like in a newspaper, or I'm walking down the street and somebody is going the other way and I hear a snatch of a conversation, I walk into an elevator or something like that, and when I get the same word three times in a short period of time, then I realize I better really pay attention to this. And a recent example this summer, and I only heard it twice, thank God.
Ooh, getting better.
I know. No. Since I didn't hear it the third time, I'm disregarding it. About 24 hours that I should write. And the last thing in the world I want to do with my life is write, which I know this is dangerous, because frequently it ends up, the thing I at least want to do is the thing I have to end up doing. So thank God I didn't hear the third person say that.
I think you should write that down.
The statute of limitations closed.
The Lord works in mysterious ways. Yes?
Sometimes it's not so much having to hear it three times as having to hear it a lot of times over a long period of time in order to convince yourself not to say no, but to say yes.
Yeah.
You know, and I guess that's my own experience.
Seminaries these days, and again, I'm not pressing anyone to go to seminary, although I'd like to have a job for a while longer, are full of people who are second and third careers. And they're second and third, preparing for second and third career. A lot of women, especially who, when they were 21, 22, finishing college, ordained ministry was just not open to them, and they did not want to be deaconesses or directors of Christian education. They felt called to be pastors, but the church and society said to them, girls can't do this. And so they went, and they were homemakers, they were in business, they just a wide variety of things that women were allowed to do 10 years ago in some cases. And had some success and some failures, and now are, you know, the third of every class, in our case, a half of every class is women. Women are flocking into seminaries, men as well, though. One of my advisors, the 50-year-old man, who went to business school because everybody in his family went to business school, and he hated every minute of it, made lots of money, and hated every minute of it. And, can't understand that myself. But now he's in seminary doing what he felt he was called to do at 21, 22.
Afford to do it.
Pardon?
He can afford to do it.
He can. No, actually, he can't.
He had a lot of money, you said.
He made a lot of money.
Oh. I said he spent a lot of money.
He spent a lot of money. There was one other hand over here. Oh.
Well, I just wanted to mention that as a child, during Mission Emphasis Week at Zion Lutheran Church in Seattle, the Bible passage, "Behold, the fields are white unto harvest, but the laborers are few," impressed me. And it seems to me that at various stages of my life, this verse has just crystallized freshly, and it has been a directional for the choice that I made. And one of them in particular was when an opening occurred in Snohomish County Mental Health Services. And I had always identified, of course, the mission field as being far away places. And I found that the door was open only 10 months. But it was the directional that caused me to accept that particular position. And I found that over and over, I would say maybe 350 people in that time that I was able to, as a choice, to offer the gospel message. Mm-hmm. And then the door closed.
It's really important. To not, as important obviously as I think ordained ministry is and professional ministry in the church is, I think it's really important to remember that ministry happens in all sorts of forms. Samuel is set up as a unique case here, and perhaps he is, but I don't know, who's ordinary?
Peter, it occurs to me that the Lord works differently than we do. If Eli were, in case you hadn't noticed, if Eli were kind of in charge there, and he was slow but working to capacity, he was doing what he could, and what would have happened had Yahweh, instead of going to this kid who lacks source credibility, if he went to Eli and said, "Wake up, I've got my eye on this kid, Samuel, I want you to open the door for him," and it would have been within established channels. Mm-hmm. It's kind of, we set up our institutions as if we expect that.
Yeah, it's interesting, but in some ways that does happen. And Eli misses the boat in several steps. Now, Hannah's there praying, and he thinks she's drunk. Yeah. Hannah comes back, "Remember me? I'm the drunk woman, and here's the boy that I was praying for, and he's going to stay here with you." And he's the schlepper. But he is there. I mean, he is. I sort of set him up as counter establishment, but he is in the religious and to some extent political establishment in that center, learning some things from Eli, I'm sure. But if he had learned from Hophni and Phinehas and Eli how to be a priest, we might have a very different story. Mm-hmm. Like, who knows what kind of curse we would elect president if that were the example we had.
Is Hannah ever mentioned again?
I don't think so. I don't think she is. But let me give myself enough to check that. She's mentioned I've got the two Bibles there. She's mentioned as bearing three sons and two daughters. But I don't think she's mentioned again, except she gets a very strong reference, which we're going to look at in just a minute, an allusion to her in that other part of the Bible called the New Testament. Now, Pam is afraid to write. It just takes up too much of your life. It really messes things up. There's a writer's magazine that sells a t-shirt that said, "Writing is a life sentence," which is a clever pun. Fear is a great motivator and a great debilitator. What people tell you can do and what you know you can't do. But let's, someone pick up verse 10 through 18.
Okay.
when the Lord came and stood forth, calling as at other times, Samuel, Samuel. And Samuel said, Speak, for thy servant heareth. Then the Lord said to Samuel, Behold, I am about to do a thing in Israel, at which the two, now my eyes don't want to show.
Ears.
The two ears of every one that bears, I will tingle, it will tingle. On that day I will fulfill again, Eli, all that I have spoken concerning, let me read that again. On that day I will fulfill against Eli, all that day I have, will fill, oh gee.
Let me pick up here, right?
Yeah.
Because I'm
originally. I can't see it.
On that day I will fulfill against Eli all that I have spoken concerning his house from beginning to end. For I have told him that I am about to punish his house forever for the iniquity that he knew, because his sons were blaspheming God, and he did not restrain them. Therefore I swear to the house of Eli that the iniquity of Eli's house shall not be expiated by sacrifice or offering forever. Right. Samuel lay there till morning, then opened the doors of the house of the Lord. Samuel was afraid to tell the vision to Eli. Well, what a surprise. But Eli called Samuel and said, Samuel, my son. He said, Here I am. Eli said, What was it that he told you? Do not hide it from me. May God do so to you and more. Also, if you hide anything from me of all that he told you, that do to you and more is a typical Hebrew curse formula. So Samuel told him everything. So Samuel's so afraid that he has to be bound by a curse to tell him what the vision is. And told him everything and hid nothing from him. Then he said, It is the Lord, let him do, this is Eli speaking, I believe. It is the Lord, let him do what seems good to him. So being called, being relatively certain, doesn't stop anyone from being afraid to do what they can even be very certain that they're called to do. So someone else tell Pam she should write. We've only got 3 and a half hours to convince you. And Samuel grew up, and the Lord was with him, and let none of his words fall on the ground. And all Israel from Dan in the northern end at this point to Beersheba, the southern end of Israel, knew that Samuel was a trustworthy prophet of the Lord, that the Lord continued to appear at Shiloh, for the Lord revealed himself to Samuel. So we go from the beginning of the chapter, of chapter 3, to the visions being rare in those days, the word of the Lord being rare and visions being not widespread, to the end of the chapter with Samuel being known as a trustworthy prophet, and knowing that if you want to make contact with God, that Shiloh might be a place to do that. Somebody on this side of the room look up Luke 1:46 through 56. Somebody on the right side of the room, get that ready for me. And someone on this side of the room, if you'll go to the beginning of chapter 2 in 1 Samuel and read that for us. The Magnificat, which someone over here will read for us, was the text, the gospel text for Sunday night. Luke 1:46 through 56.
Hannah also prayed and said, this is when she brought Samuel as a baby. My heart exults in the Lord, my strength is exalted in the Lord. My mouth derides my enemies because I rejoice in thy salvation. There is none holy like the Lord, there is none beside thee. There is no rock like our God. Talk no more so very proudly, let not arrogance come from your mouth. For the Lord is a God of knowledge, and by him actions are weighed. The bows of the mighty are broken, but the feeble gird on strength. Those who were full have hired themselves out for bread, but those who were hungry have ceased to hunger. The barren have borne 7, but she who has many children is forlorn. The Lord kills and brings to life. He brings down to Sheol and raises up. The Lord makes poor and makes rich. He brings low. He also exalts. He raises up the poor from the dust. He lifts the needy from the ash heap, to make them sit with princes and inherit a seat of honor. For the pillars of the earth are the Lord's, and on them has he set the world. He will guard the feet of his faithful ones, but the wicked shall be cut off in darkness. For not by might shall a man prevail. The adversaries of the Lord shall be broken to pieces. Against them he will thunder in heaven. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth. He will give strength to his king and exalt the power of his anointed.
Just for those of you who were here yesterday, this ends with power, strength to his king, power to his anointed. Another hint that this is about someone who's going to rule the nation. Did someone got it for us?
And Mary said, "My soul magnifies the Lord, and my spirit rejoices in God my Savior, for he has regarded the low estate of his handmaiden. For behold, henceforth all generations will call me blessed. For he who is mighty has done great things for me, and holy is his name. And his mercy is on those who fear him from generation to generation. He has shown strength with his arm. He has scattered the proud in the imagination of their hearts. He has put down the mighty from their thrones and exalted those of low degree. He has filled the hungry with good things, and the rich he has sent empty away. He has helped his servant Israel in remembrance of his mercy, as he spoke to our fathers, to Abraham and to his posterity forever." And Mary remained with her about 3 months and returned her home. She stopped 55.
Thanks. So the reversal of the strength and the strong and the weak, the reversal of the hungry and those who are full and the rich and the poor, all things picked up in the Magnificat at the birth of Jesus, also picked up, which are borrowed from the tradition of this is whom God sends. This is how you know God is active, when the formerly wealthy are brought low and the poor, formerly poor are brought high, or at least there's some, approaching of equity and financial resources and in food. Those who, the barrenness isn't there, some sort of equity and strength, which is the same thing in our culture, the finances for the most part. These things that that are signs for the Israelites and for the early Christians, that God is very active. These are the things I often tell people, that these are the things I think we should be reading at baptisms. To remind ourselves of what we expect of our children. Not to lay too heavy an expectation on them or on the parents who will raise them, because we don't, when we baptize children in most of the Christian churches, we don't say that the parents are going to do it. We say at least the parents and the godparents, and then we extend that to the whole congregation. But the kind of the kind of hope rather than expectation that we have for each child, because we don't know, like Eli didn't know who Samuel was when Samuel was deposited at his feet as a young boy who could only go fetch things for him. We don't know which one will be the great prophet, the great statesman, the great stateswoman, or maybe the one who ushers in the return of the Messiah. We need to treat every child of God that way, whether they're 2 or 102, because it's never for us to judge.